Good evening, Telescope. Thank you for being here for our final session in this venue that was brand new this year. Hope you've had a chance to check out some of the content over the weekend. We've had a really wide range of content. You can see some signs around the edge of some of the drop-in sessions we've done. It's been an effort to bring more discussion about science, about technology, about various themes that are changing our society into the festival program. I'm James. I've helped put that together. I'd love to hear any of your feedback after this session. But don't want to hold up getting started. So I'm really glad to welcome Ade Adewunmi to Greenbelt, first time at the festival. Ade and I worked together for quite a few years working in government, sort of pushing digital change and new ways of working into government. And Ade always kind of sat at the sort of the meeting point of the technology thinking, the policy thinking, the strategy thinking of what we were doing. So I was really glad that she agreed to come and help us think a bit about how we grapple with the complexity of the systems that we're within, the way that technology is changing and shaping, and how we cut through that and get to what we value and what's important to us. So please join me in welcoming Ade Adewunmi.
Thanks, everyone. As James said, my name's Ade. I'm hoping to spend the next hour or so just talking through, and because of the turnout, which I think is perfect, I'm hoping we can have a really good conversation. So I have enough material to kind of keep going, but I don't know, would this be all right? That if people have questions as I go through, because we're not a big crowd, to just kind of throw them in? I have examples, and I'm going to try and make this as practical as possible, but throw in examples or real life situations that you're facing and how you're trying to navigate those things. I think it'll make for a more interesting discussion, although my slides are amazing, so don't be worried about that.
And I have a it's not on yet. I have a roving mic here, so if anybody has anything they want to throw in, if you put your hand up, I'll bring you the microphone.
Cool. All right, so I think this conversation is really pertinent because there's a growing awareness of how technology is affecting our lives. And so I don't think it's a controversial statement to say that our online lives are pretty much our real lives. I don't think that's a controversial statement. However, I do say this to family members who go, well, that's why I'm not on Facebook, or that's why I'm not on Twitter. And just in case there's anyone who kind of thinks that, I'm going to cite some examples that just kind of demonstrate how you're in whether you like it or not. Okay. So, if like me, you live in London and you travel on public transport, either because it's an ecologically friendly way to get around or because you just like being pressed against strangers, you probably use an Oyster card. And the reason you would do that is because it is significantly cheaper to travel using an Oyster card than to get a paper ticket. The minute you do that, though, your all sorts of data about your movements and your travel are recorded, and they're recorded in the centrally controlled system. Now, if you do that using your contactless credit card, even more so. Now, and we'll get to this at the end, there's an explanation that Transport for London give about how they're trying to not collect and hold on to personal data about people who use various forms of public transport. But the reality is, for a variety of reasons, mostly around expedience, when you use the Oyster, your Oyster, and travel around London, your name, your details, your personal details, but also your movements are recorded as a matter of course. And say you decide that your privacy is way too important and you're going to pay the premium and get a paper ticket and travel around that way, there's no guarantee that someone, one of your fellow passengers, won't think you're really cute and take a picture of you and post it on this massively intrusive website called Tube Crush, because that's what people do, and post all sorts of details about you without your permission anyway. And say you manage to avoid that, because you're super vigilant, there's no guarantee that an employer, a prospective employer, isn't Googling you as a matter of course, and more employers do this, And then maybe you're thinking, well, it still wouldn't get me because I'm not a prolific tweeter, I'm not on Facebook, they wouldn't actually find that much information about me, so I'm safe. Actually, your lack of online presence could do you in as well. So the fact that actually no one can find stuff about you could raise flags depending on what the organization's policy is with regards to how it goes about recruiting. The fact that all of this stuff doesn't need, well, until very recently, there are now guidelines suggesting that this kind of intrusive behavior shouldn't be the norm. But actually, companies were doing this without any regulation or any checking. They could just do that. And their argument was, well, this is public information. Someone's posted this information on a social networking site, and therefore it's fair game. And if you live in the States, sorry, I'm just going to get the scare stories out of the way now, just so there's anyone feeling they're safe and this doesn't somehow apply to them. In the States, you might have the misfortune to belong to do business with an insurance company that is doing business with hospitals to using data brokers to collect all sorts of information about you from various other sources. It's the same sort of information that is used for credit ratings and the same sort of information that's used to do checks, employment checks, for example. Now, again, this is a completely unregulated market. So data brokers in the States, but also here in the UK, are completely unregulated. No one really knows quite how prolific they are or how they go about gathering this data. And they generally don't get investigated by the ICO because the ICO is significantly underfunded. They don't get investigated until they're caught up in some sort of scandal or the other. So here you have this insurance company working with hospitals, well, Carolina's Healthcare, to collect information via various other sources, undisclosed sources, that they then use to build a profile. So this is not anonymized data. This is about specific individuals to find out how risky they are, whether they indulge in behaviors that the insurance company considers to be high-risk behavior. Now, the way this has been sold is that, well, actually, this allows the hospital and the insurer to better support you. Now, no one's that gullible. Yeah. So I'll just stop. Okay, and the last one I'm going to skip because we have young people in the audience as well. But that was particularly hilarious. And if you're interested, I can tell you about it later. But I found it hilarious because I have the sense of humor of a very small child. Because increasingly there are very few places you can go to and there are very few facets of society that you can engage in where your data isn't being collected. So if you have the belief that there is a way of opting out of this, it really doesn't matter. There isn't. And actually, even if you manage to completely stay off the grid, your very absence from it becomes problematic in a world that is increasingly surveilled and where this information is becoming the norm. This data gathering is becoming the norm. So actually, you begin to set off flags because you don't have an online presence. In the same way that not having a credit card or ever using credit puts you at a disadvantage if you then choose to try and buy a house, for example. So the point I'm making is this becomes ever more complex. And for me, I started seeing parallels with climate change, where on the one hand, you realize that bad things are happening, something needs to be done, but you are one individual and this is huge. And you recognize also that your action alone as one individual doesn't bring about the changes that are necessary if we are to start addressing issues of climate change. Or did I say global change? I meant global warming and climate change. Anyway, you figure that out. That's massive iceberg breaking off, probably gave it away. And so I started just kind of thinking about this and the parallels, and I came across a blog post that a guy called Connor Quinn produced on the RSA blog post, the RSA blog. And he was talking about just the sort of transition that he had to go on from making being a climate change activist something that was a cerebral activity into something that was really practical, given that you can't do all the things. And if you can't do all the things, what is a useful thing to do? So he was making the point that it's actually quite disheartening when you think about the fact that you are one person, there's a lot to be done, it's really difficult to do. How do you just not give up in despair? And I wanted to get a Lord of the Rings reference in. Because this is how you feel, right? At least this is how I feel at times. I'm just like, this is too big a challenge. And so then we have the question of where does our individual action, our individual responsibility meet with group action, collective action? And so he used the example of becoming a vegetarian. And he was talking about how, having accepted that something needed to be done, he still couldn't quite bring himself to make such a fundamental life-changing decision. He just couldn't get motivated enough to do it. And the first thing he needed to do was to fire up his imagination. So he had to be able to move beyond the sausages and hamburgers he was consuming, so this on an individual scale, and extrapolating that to something, to a scale that made this significant, made it important enough for him to get excited or scared enough to realize something had to be done. Then after he did that, he started investigating the wider context. So what was the ecosystem that was supporting or facilitating his eating meat or various meat products? And then once he decided, well, okay, this is a big problem, I've understood the wider context and what facilitates that, then he could kind of pick a battle. And for him, it was becoming vegetarian or vegan, I think vegetarian. And then on the back of that, he said, having done that, made that decision, the moral and economic argument were clear, he still found it really hard to maintain that lifestyle. And this was where being part of a wider group became really important, that he was hanging out and engaging with others who were on a similar journey. And that was important for all those days when you are the lone vegetarian in a group of meat-eating friends who goes to a restaurant that just doesn't believe that vegetarians really exist and don't cater for them, and then offers you a salad when you're starving and you're really depressed. And the salad, of course, is as expensive as the meat option, and you're just really irritated. So staying motivated through all of that. And he just talked about that journey. And I thought that was a really nice framework for kind of thinking through how we think about wanting to do the ethical thing when it comes to navigating technology in our world. So there were three themes that I thought would be useful to explore, and they're imagination, context, and courage. Now, I'm a Doctor Who fan, and at least part of that means having a high level of tolerance, no, not tolerance, love for just really bad CGI, just bad special effects, and that's part of its charm. I love it. So actually, ever watching an episode of Doctor Who where the CGI is anything but atrocious is a surprise, and not even a pleasant one. I'm just kind of really irritated. But the idea that privacy infringements would take place if you have indiscriminate collection of personal data, that shouldn't be a surprise. No one should be surprised by that. And yet, the no one could have possibly seen this coming is a recurring theme in various mea culpas. When people are now faced with the idea that Facebook hasn't been properly checking who they're sharing data with, or that they're selling data in potentially unethical ways, or selling profiles of their users in potentially unethical ways. And I don't even know. I mean, I've said this on the theme imagination, but I'm not even sure that this is a question of poor imagination. I think it's willful refusal to engage with where these things could go. So just to kind of bring it home, I wanted to cite an example of a case where the FBI were after a burglar, and they knew where the burglary had taken place roughly. And in order to, because obviously before Google, there were no burglars, and there are no other ways of solving crimes. But what the FBI did was to subpoena Google and request access to all users within, well, you can read, these are the parameters. Now, this is massively intrusive and unnecessary. And I don't think, actually, and I assure you I'm not a conspiracy theorist, I don't think the aim here was really to solve this particular crime. This is more a sort of attritional battle of, because in actual fact, they found the person they were looking for and Google didn't provide the information. So it stalled and stalled and stalled. And the only reason this came out at all was because someone FOI'd court records, and that's how they found out about it. But the point here is to test the law, right? So for the FBI to do this, they had to get a judge willing to sign off on that. And some judge somewhere thought that trying to find a single burglar meant that this level of intrusion was okay. And I think it's really important to think about that. Actually, I'll just stop and ask people, what is your reaction when you see that? Does it seem reasonable? As in, is your first thought, because I've shared this with family and friends, and I've had some people kind of go, well, if the police needed the access to this information, then they should be given it. And I'm just curious, just for the show of hands, how many people think, I've kind of ruined it because I've kind of said my position, and now it's going to be awkward if you're like, actually, I think it's fine. All right, next one. I won't do that, and I'll ask. I feel like I've ruined it already. I think there's, you can tell where I stand on these issues. I'm just going to keep going. Sorry. Okay, so the point was, if there were really strict parameters around it, and they could view it for maybe a week or something, then that would be acceptable.
So, I mean, to draw a parallel, possibly, in my head, it's like saying that you, within 45 hectares, you can go and search anybody's home without a warrant. It's like a sort of blanket warrant just to walk in, because the robber may be in that house, and I don't think people would find that level of intrusion acceptable. So that's the parallel in my mind.
Yeah. Anyone else? Any other thoughts?
I don't like it, but I'm just wondering, how would we all feel if that wasn't two robberies, it was two murders?
And that's a really good question.
And if it was two murders of children... Sorry, let's leave it there.
So again, I think the point that was made here is the one to consider. If it were two murders of children is such an emotive example that I'm going to leave that to the side just for a second and say... So say it was two murders. Would we think it reasonable, if the police had sufficient resources, would we think it reasonable to open up our homes to be searched because we wanted to catch whoever had committed two murders? Would we consider that reasonable?
So is another analogy, there are places where people are asked to provide DNA samples. You know, everybody in a particular area is asked to provide DNA samples in order to reduce, you know, to try and identify the culprit. Yeah. So at one level, that's the same kind of thing because it's a large data set you're going to trawl through. On the other hand, there is an element of opt-in.
Yes, that's the point I was going to make.
There's also an element of, if you don't opt in...
Why haven't you opted in?
Yeah.
And... Yes. So if you choose not to opt in and people go, ooh, why haven't you? The police would still have to do the work to, they would either have to get a judge, although we can see from here that there are judges who are willing to play that game. But it's still a lot harder for them. In this particular instance, and this is the danger of these massively centralized data gathering websites, is that actually the burden on police and other law enforcement agencies drops significantly if they can bully these organizations into sharing that data. And depending on, and remember, all of this was happening in secret. So the fact that this came out at all was by accident, right? So you wouldn't know if Google had shared that, if they'd caved and shared it. Now, Google and Facebook and others are in a tricky position now, because if it gets out that they have shared, then their entire business model is under threat, because Google, Facebook and others need us to be actively engaged on their websites in order to continue this gathering process. Now, they do it because selling information about our behavior and building profiles around us is profitable, because they can sell that to advertisers. But again, it takes a significant failure of imagination to not see that surveillance is the next step. Sorry.
I'm just thinking, you've got all of the information on the phones which the FBI are wanting to get. Can they not just pay for advertising, pull data, because everyone's willing to just accept whatever to use an app, and just to drop that in on any app, they've got all of those phones?
So there are good reasons why it would be a foolhardy police department that would try that, because they would almost certainly get caught. And it's always the cover-up that gets you, right? It's doing it in that way would be what would get them in trouble. But bullying Google into sharing that data on the back of a judge-approved subpoena is a very different matter. But yeah, I mean, they could. And I'm going to cite some examples where police departments do, where they haven't gone via the legal routes in order to get around legislation, where they've instead just gone to data brokers who are, again, largely unregulated, and collected the information that way. So I work in tech, and I am a huge fan of GDPR. GDPR is the EU legislation, the updates to the Data Protection Act, if you like. And it introduced all sorts of new protections for consumers. One of them is data portability. And I was really excited about data portability. I think I still think it has potential. And essentially what data portability allows is it stops your data being trapped with a particular platform, right? So say you've built this amazing network of friends and people on Facebook. Now, network effects work because the vast majority of us are on Facebook, right? That's dominating the market share in that way is really key to Facebook's business model, right? If there were very few of us on there, then they're not able to build as interesting profiles, which therefore is less attractive to advertisers. So the fact that we're all on there is super, super important. But from an economic angle as well, network effects come into play, because if we're all on there, then Facebook acts as a near monopoly on this stuff. It's an excellent way of killing off competitors. Now, one of the things that responsible states would want to do is to reduce the possibility of monopolies arising in that way. And data portability is one of the ways they can do that. So if you're able to take your data off Facebook and onto some other startup, then you reduce the risk of an all-powerful Facebook. That's the theory. So for reasons like this, I'm a huge fan of data portability. Also, I think if there is a viable alternative, it just makes organizations behave better. And so when GDPR first came out, I was one of the huge sort of advocates for it. I thought this was amazing. But then I started doing this, you know, imagination test. Where could this lead? Now, I'm going to step out of ostensibly tech world into utility providers. A nice, boring, basic plumbing service. So I moved house 2.5 years ago. And when I moved in, my landlord had in the contract that I couldn't change the electricity supplier. So I couldn't bring my contract over from my last place. I had to go with Eon. And in setting up, I was asked if I wanted to go via direct debit. And I thought, yeah, why not? It's easy. I always forget. This takes the stress out of it. And then I was told, oh, but you realize we will have to do a credit check on you. Now, just before that, you know, I know I'm getting older because I'm turning into my dad and everything just becomes this long-winded story. Forgive me. There is a point to this. So it was Thursday. The sun was shining. And there I was thinking to myself. So I'd had a conversation with a friend a week before who, for a variety of reasons, doesn't have an excellent credit score. And she was applying for a job that had absolutely nothing to do with her credit worthiness. It wasn't a requirement for anything. She had no fiduciary responsibility. She wasn't a director of a company. She wasn't starting up a company or anything else. And she got credit checked. And because she didn't have a good enough score, she was at risk of not getting that job. Now, this annoyed me hugely because, again, this is what happens when you have poorly regulated and yet highly intrusive systems in place. So because the facility to credit check people exists and because its use isn't widely regulated, this organization she wanted to work with had taken the decision that they were just going to credit check all their employees. And because they had outsourced the recruitment process, the recruiter they were using did that as a matter of course because it was efficient. I don't think they had any malicious intent. It was just efficient. There are people within that organization that do work with money, and they just did it for everyone, even though it had nothing to do with her job. Now, this is the kind of coercive power that a large corporation has. She, as an individual, could decide not to go for that job, and she works in a field that means that there are many other opportunities, so she wasn't left too badly off by this. But imagine if you didn't work you weren't working in a position where you could easily go work somewhere else. Because this corporation had decided they were going to overly check people, you might lose out on an economic opportunity. And so back to the utility company, when they said they were going to do a credit check, having just had that conversation, I was like, well, I don't want you to do a credit check. And they went, okay, fine, we won't do a credit check. But if you are going to get direct debits, no, but then you won't be able to have the direct debit option. And then you'll have to pay, I don't know, £10 more or something. Now, I'm bloody minded enough that I was like, yeah, let's do that then. See if I care. But that is a matter of privilege. I can afford to pay more in order to take this principled stance that I will not submit to a credit check when I don't think it's necessary. Not everyone has that option. And these things erode over time. So our rights in these areas erode slowly. And this is one of the things that data portability, which I'm looking at and seeing all its potential for good, could also be used for. So here, and I imagine this is what the EU legislators had in mind as well, is that this empowers the end user, empowers the citizen, the consumer. I can decide I'm taking my data off Facebook and I'm going to move it to LinkedIn, or I'm going to move it to this brand new startup here that no one's ever heard about, because that's my right. What could also happen, and will very likely happen, is organizations will start to demand access to said data. First of all, it will start out as if you let us have access to data that was collected about you on Facebook, then we'll give you a discount. And then because we want the discount, we'll all do that. Then in a little while, it will be as a matter of course. And if the organization is powerful enough and there are too few opportunities for you to move your data elsewhere, you will have to submit. And this is the coercive power of organizations. And then it's more likely to work that way than the other way around, because we are individuals and we're not very good anymore at collective action. Does that make sense? I'm worried that I'm kind of like rambling a bit. Does that make sense? Yes, please. Sorry.
So I was also very enthusiastic about the concept of data portability, because it seemed like a way out of this horror story of having to hand over your personal data to these Californian corporations. But a couple of questions. Do we now have the theoretical power of the GDPR to say to Facebook or somebody else, we want our data back, transfer it to somebody else? And two, how did the whole GDPR thing just become about you have to confirm with numerous people whether or not you want to be on their database for sending you email updates, which seems kind of a banal interpretation of the possibilities of this?
Good questions. So on the first bit about data, do we now have the power? In practice, no, because the legislation, and this is why legislation is always such a crude, it's a crude instrument, but there, no, an organization has up to a month to provide you with that data. And there are no restrictions on how they perform, how they give you that data. So it may well be that not only will they slow you down sufficiently, so if you're looking to move to a startup, chances are they can't wait around for a month they can't wait for a month to get that data. If you were, especially if that data is around you finding a better deal, you're unlikely to wait a month in order to make that switch. So again, they're hoping, so you can see how large organizations would use that to just actually kill off any enthusiasm you have for using it. But secondly, even with GDPR, it will require us as, and this will have to be via collective action, testing some of these things and forcing regulators to take decisions and decide one way or another for some of these things. On the point about getting all those irritating emails just kind of going, you know, we've signed you up for this, are you happy to stay on our databases? While it's irritating, it's an important principle. I'm going to come to one of the organizations I will cite begins to demonstrate why that's really important, even though it's super irritating. That's okay. All right. So yeah, the second point is around context. So once we begin to imagine ways that even benign, potentially positive legislation can be used against us, then we start to see we need to understand the context a bit more. And there are all sorts of things that shape context. So I don't know how many people have heard about the credit scoring system in China. Just show of hands, you've heard about it? Okay. So in China, the Chinese government has set itself the target of having every one of its citizens having a credit score by 2020. Now, when this was first proposed, it was proposed largely a solution to the problem of the unbanked. So in its move towards capitalism, one of the challenges, and I found this really interesting because this is often a problem that is cited in many African nations as well, who would also be playing around with this sort of idea. So the idea is that because you don't have the legacy capital infrastructure that we do in the West, it's really difficult if you're an organization to make a judgment about someone's creditworthiness. And that one of the ways around that is to give everyone a credit score, and it would reduce the friction in just transactions, which sounds fairly benign, right? It doesn't sound like such an awful thing unless, you know, you've ever read sci-fi. Okay, and so Emily Rala is a journalist, and she was on a train in Beijing when this announcement came up. So basically, and there are loads of stories like this. If you litter and you get arrested, it affects your credit score. All sorts of things begin to affect your credit score. And because the credit score affects your ability to live and do business, essentially it becomes a coercive tool of the state. So you fall afoul of the state, it affects your credit score. That affects your ability to get housing. It affects your ability to get a job. It affects your ability. It begins to affect people who associate with you. And if we go back to the example where Many of us are on social media networks. It means that people who associate with you on social media could also be negatively impacted because they are associated with you. I'm going to pause for dramatic effect. And then I'm going to say, how many people on hearing this think, well, that's China? I would love to hear a bit more about whether... Yeah, I'd just like to hear a bit more about your thinking on that, in that that's China, it's unlikely to happen here, or that's China, and so there are cultural... There's a cultural framework that means that this is more likely to happen there than it is to happen here. I'd be interested in hearing a bit more as to your rationale for that. Well, that's China. Sir? Sorry, I mean to put you on the spot. If you don't want to answer, that's fine.
I think that's it was just a reflex reaction, because you realize China isn't a free society. And it's kind of conflicted between becoming a freer, sort of more capitalist society, but still maintaining centralized control. I can see that in other contexts, similar scoring systems might be used for individuals. Not something as overt as a credit score, but perhaps a likelihood to commit a crime or whether they should be under surveillance.
Anyone else? Yeah, okay, there's a gentleman just there.
So I might not be answering your question, so okay. Forgive me. But so I didn't go, but that's China. Because I think, although we don't have the same status as China, the sort of... Where it takes me is like the engagement with corporations, the engagement as a consumer, et cetera, or an employee, where it is in the interest of that organization to be associated with certain types of people, either as consumers or as employees, you know, a bit like you cited earlier. And therefore, those sorts of things can start happening. It might not be whether you drop litter, but it might be whether you go to a particular bar or you associate with a particular type of music, or and so I can see that not in a oppressive state way, almost in a sort of business corporate way, but is having similar effects, particularly to people who are not part of the mainstream, etc., etc.
Sir, did you want to say something?
Yeah, initially I thought it probably would be because China's sort of a totalitarian state, sort of it wouldn't apply to a democracy. But I think probably with global corporations working the way they do, it would become an option that might well be kind of brought in some other way.
Yes. Yeah. I'm just curious, how many people know how credit scoring works? Could, you know, if you know what your credit score is, I love this. When I ask this question of a British audience, almost no one knows. But I ask it of Americans, and they can tell you what their credit score is. But how many people know what their credit score is and know how it was calculated? I think this is really, really important. I think one of the reasons why we are relatively sanguine about not knowing what our credit score is because we live in a country where many of those rights have been fought for in previous generations and enshrined in legislation, and we trust that the regulation is working as it ought. Now, when it comes to credit scoring and financial services, these are old industries. And so there's been a lot of time to introduce the sort of legislation that means that we can afford to be relaxed about how those things get calculated, even though they affect, you know, our access to finance, our access to our ability to buy a house and things like that. But this industry is young, which means that there aren't those regulations and protections in place. And I think one of the risks is that we transfer the trust we have in the older industries and their regulation into this. And actually, it's precisely because this isn't regulated that it's so powerful and useful to corporations to be able to do things that they can't get away with in other areas. So when I cited the example earlier of the insurers and the hospitals in America, America has really robust regulation around personal data for health. Really robust regulation. The way they've sidestepped that is to simply go off and buy this data off data brokers because it's not regulated. Now, if you don't know how your credit score was calculated, I think we should be a lot less relaxed about this. Because the fact that the data exists means that we should expect that it will be used. We should allow our imaginations to run a little bit free when it comes to the idea of how this data is collected, why it's collected. And I hasten to add, it's not being collected in the West because the state mandated it so. It's being collected in the West so that large organizations can flog us more stuff. But the end results could still, I mean, we can get to bad via bad, but we can also get to bad via stupid. And I fear that that's... Oh, there, I've just declared my position. I fear that that's where we're going. Okay, so one of the things that I always encourage people to ask, and I tweet about incessantly, is to ask organizations how they make money. So I'm just going to let you read that for a second. So I'm just going to make the point, for its entire existence, Uber has been a loss-making organization. And not small money kind of loss-making, big money, in the billions. And yet, it has a $70 billion valuation. Now, if you were one of the investors in Uber, why would you keep pouring money in? Your end game has to be domination, right? That they will get via this loss-making approach sufficient market share that once you've killed off the competition, you can hike prices. There is no other reason you would put up with this level of loss-making except for that purpose. And it's easy to bash Uber because they make it so easy. But I'm going to highlight the darling of the fangs, Netflix. I love Netflix. I binge watch. And I binge watch even though I know they're collecting all this data on me and I don't come out well. I just watch complete rubbish. But there was an article in The Economist recently that was just highlighting how of the fangs, so Facebook, Amazon... Shouldn't have started this. I've forgotten what the second A is now. What is it? Apple, thank you. Apple, Netflix, and Google. That somehow Netflix has just managed to escape the public backlash, right? They still, in most people's minds, are really positively associated. But then again, and you know, yeah, I feel quite warmly towards them. Their business model isn't dependent on attention and data gathering in the way Facebook's and Google's is because their business model doesn't revolve around advertising. So right away, oh, sorry. Right, so there'll be even more reason to hate them too. But at the time this article went, I didn't even hear about that, really. Well, okay. We'll come back to that. I'm really interested in that. But at the time this Economist article was out earlier in the year, they hadn't announced those plans. And because they're a subscription-based, their model is subscription-based, you're thinking, well, You know, it's quite clear how they make money. Except, of course, you start to look at their valuation as well. And you realize that it's not sustainable unless they dominate the market similarly. And we continue to move towards this monopolization, winner-takes-all approach, which, again, is bad for all of us collectively. Still on the context, understanding context, and this kind of ties into the point you were making earlier, sir, about being on all these subscription lists, and in order to comply with GDPR, all these organizations going, you're on our list, please let us keep your data. Did anyone ever use UnrollMe? Yes. So UnrollMe was, I never used it, but those who did really, really liked the service. It was apparently really elegant, really well designed, and it was a means of just kind of getting off subscriptions that you no longer wanted to be part of. And then they had their scandal where it turned out they were selling aggregate data. So this was their defense, that it's aggregate data. And by that they mean deep and depersonalized. So it's aggregate depersonalized data, so you couldn't be identified as an individual. Which, depending on how they did it, is very likely a nonsense. You can reverse engineer those depersonalized aggregate lists if you buy enough data off data brokers who, as I've already said, are unregulated and have all sorts of interesting practices. But what's really interesting for me about UnrollMe, firstly, when they got caught, I love this just beautiful non-apology that their CEO put out. I'll let you read it. This is essentially the corporate equivalent of a sorry, not sorry. You should have read our privacy. You should have read what you were signing, is basically his defense. And, you know, also, how did you think we made money? What, you just thought we were giving you the service for free? Is really the tone of this apology. And then because he realized he couldn't say that, I love that at the end, he goes, but the reality is most of us, myself included, don't take the time to thoroughly review them, which is really just calling your users stupid. But when GDPR came in, they simply stopped offering their service in Europe. And this is really interesting because of what it tells us about the way their system is engineered. Loads of other organizations were able to reluctantly comply. They cannot comply. Their entire business model means that, and the way their systems are engineered means they can't comply. And what does that tell us then of this organization when it was selling that depersonalized aggregate data? If it can't comply with GDPR regulations and continue to operate, it almost certainly wasn't doing the kind of checks that would mean we could rest easy that it was selling that data in ways that didn't put us at risk. Okay. At this point, I'm hoping you're all thoroughly depressed and just about to give up. Because this bit of the talk is where I go, but don't despair. There is hope. So, yes, you're all down. It's been a bit rubbish. But that was by design. Okay. So, I don't know how many people know or remember Ellen Erson. Yeah? I don't know if you watched the video. Oh, I watched it and I was sitting, and by the end I was standing. I didn't quite cry, but I was close. How many people, are there people who don't know who she is? Okay, so she got on a plane that was carrying... out of Sweden, that was carrying a passenger who was due to be deported to Afghanistan. And she has been campaigning for changes in Sweden's deportation policy. So she got on the plane and refused to sit and began to film herself refusing to sit, knowing that if she didn't sit down, the plane couldn't take off. And she, you know, fair dues. She got up there and there were irate, irritated fellow passengers who tried to intimidate her into sitting down and shutting up, and she didn't. And eventually, the man was taken off the plane and not deported on that day. But it was a really important point. It was really important, and also just a really good use of privilege, I have to say, right? So if this had been a brown person standing up on the plane, the outcome might have been different. So it was really important that she recognized her privilege and used it in that way. I think it was a really brave and bold thing to do. It's also a very, very scary thing to do. And I think one of the challenges is that you watch this and you think, oh, I can't do that, right? I'm not, and I say this as a, honestly, I am a coward. I bruise like a peach as well. So like, I almost never do, like, I can't imagine myself doing anything like this. But I hope there are others in the room who similarly can't picture themselves doing things like this. And I want to say there are other things that we can do, because they're as amazing as Ellen is, and standing up and doing that, these are not the things that in and of themselves change a nation's policy, right? So this is important for raising awareness, it's important for profile, but in the end, we work out the details in legislation. And that requires all of us, and it requires scrutiny from all of us. And it's not just things like this. And I say that because the truth is we don't get affected equally. And I made the point about Ellen's privilege and how she chose to use it, because in the same way that there is a slow sort of chilling effect when data gets collected and law enforcement starts misusing data and things like that, there is similarly a slow sort of attrition and chipping away at our understanding of what normal is and what normal looks like. So I wanted to cite an example of this organization called Greater Change. Has anyone heard of them? It's a pilot organized, it's a pilot scheme. It's running in Oxford. And if you can, go on there. There's a, BBC did a short interview with the founder and cited this as an example of good uses of technology to hack systematic problems. And I think the way that it was presented is really dangerous, actually. Ugh. I didn't want to say that, and I wanted to go, what do you think? But now you know how I feel. And again, it's a good exercise in just kind of all the things we've been talking about already. So the idea here is loads of people don't carry cash on them anymore, and yet you want to give money to someone that you see is homeless. You want to meet an immediate need. You want to give directly, which is great. How do you do that when you don't carry cash? And how do you do that when you're worried about if, you know, a homeless person said, oh, don't worry, I've got this mobile device through which you can give me, you might, you know, can I trust it, right? So this is a way of dealing with issues of trust in a cashless, in an increasingly cashless society to support people who are less well off. Which sounds brilliant, right? But then I want to draw your attention. So the first thing that got my alarm bells going was this awful, the awful QPR code that this guy's wearing around his lanyard. So I already think there's something really dehumanizing about scanning people in order to give them that. But apparently, I won't knock it, because apparently that was something that in their research, homeless people said was really helpful and useful. Perhaps. I already find something very dehumanizing about that. But the thing I really want to draw your attention to, and I don't know if I can. No, I didn't. Okay. I'm just going to. So if you read, this is on their own website. So through contactless payments, we are able to provide rent deposits, skills courses, and identification documents for those in need. And then further up, this is their advertising material. So Michael is a homeless man. Michael has no way of showing that he will spend your money effectively. And then you start to see how technology is used for tracking. Because in the interview that this founder gave, one of the things he said was, you know, yeah, you want to give Michael money, but also you want to know how Michael's spending it. Do you? Do you want to know how Michael's spending it? That's... Then they go on to say, further down, Greater Change has been developed as a not-for-profit venture and is currently free at the point of use. And that's when my alarm bells really start ringing. Because the question we should always ask, which is, how will you make money? Eventually, the path that I see for Greater Change is to start working with maybe Department for Works and Pensions or with local authorities. And then that way we can make sure that we're only giving money to the deserving poor, and we'll know they're deserving because we can track the payments and what they spend it on. And then that way we can really target the undeserving poor and make sure that they don't get any of our hard-earned money. And I'm being facetious, but I think it's an important point. Because when I first saw this, my first thought was, this is an amazing idea. Until you start to read some of the ways that this is being targeted. I don't think any of this language is an accident, because I think the founders of Greater Change recognize that once the pilot's done, they're going to have to find probably public sector organizations that they will need to partner with who will have to pay them. And so, yeah, so the courage point is that we begin to speak out on things like this, because the same tracking technology that always gets first tried out on the less privileged in society will eventually come get us. So I don't remember, not everyone. So do you remember ASBOs when they were first launched? And there were all sorts of, it wasn't a very nuanced piece of legislation, shall we say. And there were loads of campaigners who pointed that out at the time. But it was targeted, and the rhetoric around the introduction of the legislation was targeted at people who, shall we say, were hard to like, hard to defend. And so most people just kind of shrugged it off until enterprising local authorities started using the same legislation to target upstanding members of society for bin collections. Anyone remember that? No, you're not Telegraph readers. This was a huge issue in the Telegraph. But essentially, local authorities started using that legislation to target people who were putting out bins on non-bin days. They started doing similar things with some of the anti-terror legislation. So much so that very recently government has passed legislation to stop local authorities from abusing this poorly defined legislation. It took 5 years, though. And in the meantime, local authorities were able to use it to fine people. And local authorities themselves, of course, were reacting to the various austerity cuts, which meant that they were looking to cut bin days and things like that. I cite this example only as a good reminder that it didn't start out targeting the middle classes. But once the legislation was in effect, people find all sorts of ways to abuse systems. Oh. And the same sort of legislation that's used to track how poor people spend money is the same sort of, once you're comfortable with that, once we start to do that, then it's a lot harder to argue against corporations tracking employees. Now, we know Amazon already does this, but again, it doesn't do it for its office workers yet. It does it primarily for those workers who work in its factories and in warehouses. But increasingly, actually, for white-collar jobs, you're seeing organizations start to introduce all sorts of checking. Highly intrusive ones as well. And I just want, this is my last example. And this is the city of Memphis is one of those, or is one of the local governments that has consent laws. And consent laws were introduced in the States on the back of widespread surveillance of activists starting back in the kind of civil rights era. So Memphis started all the way back then. So much, it was so egregious that these consent laws were brought in. What law enforcement started doing was, because they couldn't, via official means, legal means, track activists, what they do now is buy data off data brokers and use that information that's scraped off social media websites and places like that, and then use that to build profiles about potential troublemakers. Now, at the moment, this is Black Lives Matter, but Memphis has form for using this against workers looking to unionize, school teachers. It has basically whoever the state decides at that particular point in time is acting in ways they do not like. Once the infrastructure, once the apparatus is there, it's really hard to expect that it won't get used for those purposes. Okay, so earlier I was talking about how climate change, the Conor Quinn, the climate change activist, was saying that he had managed to kind of buoy himself up to do something about his beliefs. And here, I guess that's my message here as well. Having kind of let our imaginations run free a little bit and see just how widespread and pervasive the misuse of this technology can be, to then pick an area and decide, because we can't do all the things. I've, at this point, deleted every possible app off my phone. I've deleted Uber, deleted Facebook. Actually, I was never on Facebook, so I get to be smug about that. But generally, you find out some organization is doing something nasty. You decide not to use them. But actually, that is not enough. Because like I said at the beginning of this talk, we're all caught up anyway. Our data's already in the system. And so what we need now is collective action to begin to properly regulate the behavior of these organizations. So pick an area. Oh yeah, and be encouraged. Like, oh, that's such a depressing talk. But things do change. Like I said, when I cited the example of the FBI issuing subpoenas, well, the court issuing subpoenas on behalf of the FBI for Google. Google ignored it. It ignored it and, you know, went to court to protest and things like that. But the reason they did that is because they recognized that there is a growing understanding amongst their user base about the level of surveillance. And this messes up their business model. Because if people start to throttle themselves and don't engage as widely and as freely as they have, then their ability to build these profiles is diminished. So it's not in Google or Facebook's or Apple's interest to provide this information if it's going to get out that that's what they've done. And so the more we engage, the more we begin to make it known to legislators, to these organizations themselves, that this stuff really matters, the more they understand that it's not in their interest to behave in this way. And so you can start to see some of the effects. So once there was the backlash of kids being addicted to various social media sites and and the impacts on happiness and well-being and things like that, this came about. Similarly, you hear people like the chief data officer at Transport for London explaining how they intentionally start to break links between your movement using an Oyster card and your name, essentially to break that link. Now, I think this is cleverly... You know what? I'm just going to stop. Because if I start explaining why I'm skeptical of this, then it just ends on a depressing note. And I don't want you to leave here depressed. I hope you walk away thinking there is something you can do, because there are things you can do. Yeah, that's pretty much it.